We have a very broken healthcare system in America, and we are not going to fix it overnight. And it's not your individual responsibility to fix it. But what we can do is fix the impacts right here in our own communities. And if we all focus in on our own individual communities and take public health, we have to get to the very bottom of Maslow's hierarchy before we get to the very top. And, you know, as a young public health professional, I wanted to run up the stairs to the top all the time and just fix all the things now and get it over with and move on. You know, we fixed the system. Yay. And it's really frustrating at times to bang your head against that wall and barrier against barrier against barrier. But we have to take the time to understand what systems have been put in place, what policies have been put in place, and how do we work through each one of those barriers.
Hey friends, welcome to Public Health Careers. Today we're chatting with John Forte. John is the president and CEO at Riverstone Health and the Yellowstone County Health Officer. He's a county health officer, beekeeper, board certified healthcare executive, Eagle Scout, and a transformational servant leader. He conferred a Bachelor's of Science in Biology pre-medical at the University of Scranton and a Master of Health Administration at the University of Scranton. In today's episode, you'll hear and learn more about the way to be impactful in new places as you practice public health, leading one of the few public health model federally qualified health centers, which also houses the health department, healthcare delivery, and a home health, home hospice arm. How he convinced city council members the importance of investing in prevention work, what he did as a fellow of the American College of Healthcare Executives and as a graduate health administrative training program administrative fellow at the U.S. Department of Veterans Services, and much, much more. Be sure to subscribe and hit that like button. Enjoy today's episode.
Hey, this is John Forte. I am public health officer for Yellowstone County and president and CEO at Riverstone Health in Billings, Montana. And you're listening to Public Health Careers.
John, it's not every day I get to talk to someone in Billings, Montana. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Amari.
Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to this story. I learned a little bit about your story when you came to Public Health Happy Hour, and I thought it was fascinating. And I'm looking forward to you sharing more. And I think it's important that we share that, like, public health careers happen all across the USA, even in Montana, which I think is one of the most underratedly beautiful states in the U.S. Just putting that out there as well.
For sure. I have not had a not beautiful drive yet. Every corner is more beautiful than the next.
Right. So jumping into things, how do you identify, and tell us a little about your personal background?
Sure. My pronouns are he, him. Yeah, grew up in the Poconos in Northeast Pennsylvania, and then went to graduate and undergrad in Scranton, Pennsylvania at the University of Scranton. I grew up loving to backpack and hike on the Appalachian Trail and take advantage of what nature had in store for me. So Montana is a perfect fit for me and our family. I started out in high school teaching adaptive sports. And so outside of work, I also love to teach, you know, Special Olympics and individuals with physical and intellectual disabilities, how to get out and ski and enjoy life and the outdoors as much as I do. So that really keeps me grounded outside of our public health world that we all face stress in every single day. I'm happily married to my wife, who's also a certified nurse midwife, and she was a nurse family partnership public health nurse in Baltimore City for several years, and three wonderful kids. I also have a couple hundred thousand bees at home, as I'm a beekeeper, and really enjoy that in my spare time.
A couple hundred thousand bees. How many hives is that?
To about two hives, between 30 and 50,000 bees in each hive.
How do you estimate the number of bees that you hive?
Oh, somebody way smarter than me did that.
Okay. Understandably. And I wanted to quickly ask about the adaptive sports, and how did you get involved and interested in doing that work?
Yeah, you know, back in high school, I had the privilege of having my father be one of my school administrators. And I came to him one day and I said, you know, we take a ski club up to the mountain. It was only a couple miles away, about a 10-minute bus ride to the ski mountain every Wednesday. And we get to go skiing and have a ton of fun. But at the time, I had just started coaching a group of Special Olympians in our school. And they were skiing at a different mountain on a different day. And I went to my dad and I said, you know, we need to get a bus and we need to take these kids with us when we go skiing, and they need to be part of our ski club. And so that started it all. We got our Special Olympics core group to join our regular ski club, and we all went to the same mountain together on a weekly basis. Got a couple more students involved in teaching and providing ski coaching. And then when I joined the VA after graduate school, I really got involved in teaching folks with physical disabilities, whether it's amputees or TBIs, other issues that they had obtained from war. We were helping them overcome that and reintegrate into society through adaptive sports, whether it's kayaking, skiing, basketball, you name it. There's all sorts of opportunities out there for folks to get involved and engaged, and it really helped bridge that civilian-military divide. So it's just been a passion of mine for a really long time.
That's a very touching story, and I appreciate you sharing that with us. And I have to ask also, so you're from Scranton, you've lived in Scranton. Have you seen the members of the office before?
Not only have I seen the members of the office, my first year in graduate school, Al Roker came to the university to broadcast the Today Show. We stayed up and they had a office convention in town. And I actually got to help Phyllis around the city of Scranton as she was there and met the entire cast except for Steve Carell.
Oh. that's amazing. I could only imagine how fun that must have been.
They were the coolest famous people because they didn't know they were famous. And they were just so humble. And I think if you look at the original cast on that show, even today, they're still those same people. And it's so cool to see.
That truly is beautiful. So now jumping more into your public health and your work experience. You've worked in healthcare, community health, public health, leadership in various roles, as we'll talk about, and you've worked throughout the country as well. What does it take to move to a new place in the country and still be impactful and effective in your work?
For sure. First and foremost, it's family support. I could not do what I do without the support of my wife and my mother and my father. My entire family, just being there every step of the way and creating space for me to have those early morning and late night meetings and, being able to, provide at home for our kids and our family. Just incredibly supportive. And I thank her for that. Not enough, unfortunately, but need to do more. Then integrating into every single community that I've been in. To me, it's a really important piece of public health, of leadership, of management. Do you want to make a difference in the health and safety of your community? I have tried in every single place that I've been, whether it's Baltimore, Washington, D.C., North Carolina, here in Montana, to really engage in the community in which I'm trying to serve. So that's, either joining local Boy Scout chapter or the Chamber of Commerce or engaging in a youth leadership community forum, the Lions Club or the Rotary Exchange Club, whatever that thing is for you to get engaged with your community has really helped me find a space and a place and build a network of people, colleagues, and just other professionals outside of the healthcare and public health realm to create better connections and to have a more meaningful experience wherever we were, right? And I think just my overall willingness to adapt. One thing I didn't mention in my intro is I'm an adoptee. from birth. And my special superpower that I've, brought from my own childhood trauma and battle with depression through adoption is really just adapting and trying to fit in and love where I'm placed, giving love and accepting love. And having that ability to just get into the community and find what's there. I've also had to do a lot of unlearning in the past 6 years after I left the VA. I've unlearned a lot of bureaucratic management style and bureaucratic policies that the federal government likes to throw at you, right? It's a catch-22 sometimes, especially in this world of public health where we're very reliant on those federal dollars, and those dollars come with certain buckets that you have to behave in, right? But I also love being out in the more entrepreneurial way, just not a federal employee, able to be more nimble, strategic, and think about things a little bit differently and still be a good steward of those federal dollars and this, regulations that come with them. So you've also got to understand, particularly in this new role here in Montana, the tremendous difference that exists between our coastal cities and our academic elite institutions on the East Coast and the West Coast to Middle America. And, we talk a lot about divides in this country, and I'll talk about that later too, I think. But there's definitely a difference in how you need to play in the space and how you need to adapt. What worked for me in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore City does not work in Billings, Montana.
That's important to know, especially in public health work. Like, one solution is one solution, but we need many solutions to come to the table. And especially considering that different places around just the U.S. can be so drastically different in the assets that they have and the needs that they have and the capacities that they have. So definitely looking forward to hearing more about that. But thank you so much for sharing all of that. And I'm glad to hear, like, from the adoptee perspective, that you were able to learn from that, how to give and receive love, and how that kind of like shows up in your life as you've transferred into different communities and like making those communities some part of your, like, your home and your family, which sounds like a beautiful thing.
For sure, for sure. And every time we've moved, or every time I've had a new role presented to me, I made sure that it was personally the right fit. And there were a couple roles that weren't. I didn't do a good job of that. But when I took this role, I made sure that I knew what I wanted to find, and I knew what I was missing. And, finding the organizational culture, finding the team, finding the commitment to the community, all of those things that align with you as a job seeker, I knew that this was going to be a great fit and a special place just based on the interview experience. And how they brought the entire community in to interview me for 2 straight 8-hour days and review that process. It was a place that I knew that I could be and live and work and raise a family.
I love that. And that just shows a lot. And I think it's important as public health professionals to build ourselves and get the skill sets and experiences that we want, so that when opportunities come our way, we can say, okay, we want to do this job because it provides the types of supports and the type of lifestyle that I want to live. Because I think too often we get dragged into a lifestyle that isn't something that we ideally want. And that takes a toll on our mental health, on burnout, and all these different things. So it really is trying to position yourself into positions where you are fitting culturally and many things are aligned, so that you aren't, like, it isn't that much, like, of course work is going to be work, but it isn't going to be that much more challenging as it's going to be in an organization or in a place that just isn't a right fit for you.
For sure. For sure. My wife and I give ourselves a year when we've entered a new place, because we've really found that it takes that full year, maybe a year and a half, to find your people, to find your fit, to find things that you like to do, to find those hidden spots in the community that, you know, you're going to fit in and really enjoy. And I, as I've just passed a year in the seat here in Montana, it has proven true again. It's taken us about a good year to really feel like we're getting settled and we're in the right place.
And as I shared earlier, we met at one of the public health happy hours that I'm having. Definitely go register if you have not been to one as yet. And one of the things I highlighted in that happy hour, as well as, like, I think it's just important for public health professionals to know and to talk about, is you shared a story around having to convince city council members of the importance of investing in prevention. Can you share more about this?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And you know, fortunately, it was an amazing team here that has been chipping away at local community leaders, at city council and the mayor's office, and, you know, just educating and sharing data and sharing information. You know, they finally convinced them to invest in our nurse family partnership programs and in an evidence-based approach to solving a problem in this community right now, which is safety and crime and violence. And we've found that, you know, through NFP programs, I'm sure your listeners know this, that there are real impacts that if we can make in the early childhood programs, in investing in new mothers and new families, that we can reduce crime. We can reduce the likelihood of somebody ending up in the justice system. We can improve their literacy. We can improve their home life and create a supportive family environment. We can dramatically decrease the impact of domestic violence and other negative impacts on a family. And if we can reduce those negative childhood experiences and decrease childhood trauma, and improve the positive childhood experiences, it's going to have a societal impact. And having that conversation with elected officials who sometimes have 2 to 4 years in an office, they're not going to see the return on their investment in those 2 to 4 years, most likely. But we know that the data shows we can truly make a difference in this community by focusing on our kids, by focusing on our parents, our educational system, et cetera. And we've just shown time and time again, enough data and enough information and brought folks along in the conversation to meeting people where they are. Meet your elected officials where they are. They could be totally against the work that you do in public health for their own reasons that are in their own mind. And you just need to understand that and meet them where they are on that journey and ask them why they feel that way. And don't get defensive. You know, don't get standoffish and walk out of the room when they might be spreading misinformation or non-factual information, right? But let them share why they feel the way they feel. And then bring the facts. Bring the data, bring the information, and bring the outcomes, bring the potential outcomes that they could see in their community, and bring communities of like size, like demographic makeup, so that they don't see, you know, Billings, Montana versus New York City, or, you know, another unlikely pairing of cities, right? You've got to compare like to like. And then you bring them around that table and you build a relationship. It's just like harm reduction, right? You sit down and harm reduction strategies are all about relationship building and trust building. You've got to do the same thing with your elected officials. And the moment you say something or step out of line, you know, and push them the wrong direction, you're going to lose that trust and you're going to break down that relationship.
Listening to understand, I think, is a big skill that we need to develop, not listening to react or listening to anything else, but just listening to understand. And then from there, as you're saying, meet them where they're at, get the data, the stories,
create the education, show them the outcomes for where they're at, for the things that you understand from listening to them. But this is important work, and I'm glad that you were able to do this. And I feel like this is what we need more of around the country to ensure that we are investing in prevention, that we are investing into things that are going to help us in the long run to solve a lot of the issues and challenges that we are facing today.
Absolutely.
So pivoting a little bit, right before we get into your journey in undergrad, what does public health mean to you?
This is such a loaded question, and it means something different to every single person, right? You know, there are academic definitions, but you know, to me and to our work here at Riverstone Health, our mission is to improve life, health, and safety. That is at our core. We provide health, education, leadership, and protection to Yellowstone County and all of those that we serve. We provide help. That's our acronym. You know, our primary job as public health professionals is really to fix broken systems. It's to understand the systemic inequities that our health system has created, that our governments have created, that we have individuals have created and perpetuated. And, you know, my goal in public health is to try to fix as many of those as possible. We have a very broken healthcare system in America, and we are not going to fix it overnight. And it's not your individual responsibility to fix it. But what we can do is fix the impacts right here in our own communities. And if we all focus in on our own individual communities and take public health, we have to get to the very bottom of Maslow's hierarchy before we get to the very top. And, you know, as a young public health professional, I wanted to run up the stairs to the top all the time and just fix all the things now and get it over with and move on. You know, we fixed the system. Yay. And it's really frustrating at times to bang your head against that wall and barrier against barrier against barrier. But we have to take the time to understand what systems have been put in place, what policies have been put in place, and how do we work through each one of those barriers step by step. You know, here in Billings, the exponential growth of this city and this county outpaced policy. It outpaced laws and regulations. And, you know, just like how, you know, industry, designer drugs, for example, have grown leaps and bounds and they outpaced our health policy. You know, our bureaucratic systems sometimes fail the people that they were designed to protect, and they're not quick enough to protect the public's health. And so, you know, that is really what I see our role as public health professionals doing, is taking a look at what's out there and making sure we come up with some plans and programs to help fix it. We've got to figure out how to go upstream, downstream, and direct care delivery, right? And that's why I'm here at Riverstone. That's what got me here to Billings, Montana, is this place and the fact that we have a federally qualified health center. We have a public health department. We have a home health and home hospice program. And we do it all, essentially. We are upstream, downstream, and in the middle. And if I was going to be able to make a difference on the healthcare system in this country and in the public health delivery system here, this is where I wanted to be to do that, because we have that reach.
Before we get back to the show, are you passionate about public health and looking to elevate your career, brand, and impact? Join the public health community today. Gain exclusive access to career-boosting events, connect with like-minded professionals, and stay ahead with the latest trends in public health. Plus, enjoy mentorship and career support to help you thrive. You'll even learn tips and tricks on how I grew my LinkedIn by 2,000 followers in the last 6 weeks. Sign up before the end of May to lock in your membership at the current rate before prices go up. Don't miss out on this opportunity to grow and connect. Join us at thephmillennial.com/join or in the link in the description. and be part of our vibrant community dedicated to making a difference in public health. Let's build a stronger future together. Now back to the show.
Two things I wanted to highlight, just like knowing that there are systems in place and sometimes we do feel like we're banging our heads against it. And even though it might be feeling like you're banging your head, you need to continue banging your head because we all have our individual part in playing into shifting the systems, getting the policies changed. And I really like how you're highlighting that like things take time, especially as a young professional. You know, you go in there and you're so excited and then you realize, oh, hold up, there are so many things that are like barriers after barriers after barriers, and understanding that systems have not been created like in one day, in one year. They've been created over decades, over centuries, if even. So that's really cool that you're able to highlight that. And I forgot the second thing that I was going to say, so no worries there. But yeah, so pivoting onto your journey into your bachelor's degree. So you got your bachelor's of science in biology pre-medical at the University of Scranton. What was the thought process?
Yeah, you know, from a very early age, Mario, I wanted to become a physician. I was going to medical school and there was nothing going to stop me. And I was just a trauma junkie. I loved emergency medicine from a real early age, and probably growing up with the show ER fueled that fire, right? I wanted to be in that emergency room and help save lives. And then I got exposure to, you know, a trauma center and an academic medical center and a burn unit. And I just fell in love with burns and that systemic disease process that a burn starts off in the human body. And so that was the goal. I was going to go to medical school. And for whatever reason, you know, life has, you make plans and something else gets in the way, right? That didn't work out. And I found my graduate path to getting a master's in health administration. As I was finishing up my bio degree, I also had a minor in healthcare administration. And I took the minor originally to learn as much as I could about the American healthcare system. I said, I'm going to learn laws, I'm going to learn management, I'm going to learn why our health system is so messed up. And I'm going to try to find a way to fix that. And I was a couple credits away from the dual major, essentially, after the minor. And the program director of the grad MHA program pulled me aside one day and he said, you know, you can still go to medical school, but give me 2 years. Come be my graduate assistant. Come get your master's in healthcare administration. And you'll be able to take the MCATs and apply to medical school and continue on your journey. But I really think you've got a knack for this. I want to, you know, feel it out. And so come study with me. And so I did. I took him up on the offer and I became a full-time graduate assistant, which was great because I got a graduate degree for, they paid me. And so it all worked out, right? Then as I was ending my 2-year master's degree, I was just obsessed with Obamacare and the ACA and everything that was happening around healthcare reform. And in my mind, in my young, naive mind, the VA healthcare system was America's social answer to socialized medicine, right? It was our universal healthcare program. And the VA is an amazing place. And I loved every one of the 10 years that I was there. But gosh, how wrong was I to think that was going to solve our healthcare problems? So I was attracted to a fellowship in the VA health system. And I applied to that fellowship and I got rejected. And so then I had to figure something else out. So I went back home to my home hospital, which was Pocono Medical Center, and applied for an administrative residency. I was born at Pocono Medical Center. I grew up as a volunteer at Pocono Medical Center, worked in the emergency room. I was a hospital admissions rep, same-day surgical admissions rep. I knew that hospital like the back of my hand. And fortunately enough, they granted me an administrative residency just based on the network that I was able to build there, right? 3 years in, or sorry, 3 months into that residency, got a call from the VA, and they said, "Hey, we'd like to offer you that fellowship again. Could you start next month?" And I was very excited, but very conflicted. And I had just signed and made a commitment personally to folks that I had known for years at Pocono. And I wasn't going to back out of that commitment. And so I called the VA back and I said, you know, I entered a 6-month administrative residency program and I intend to finish that out. Is there any way that I could start my fellowship January 1st, you know, the beginning of the year? I was fully prepared for them to say, no, we're going to move on to the next candidate. But fortunately enough for me, they said, sure. We'll hold until the beginning of the year and you can start after graduation. So it all worked out.
Well, that's awesome. And thank you. Thank you for walking us through that. Just want to take you back to undergrad for a little bit here. So you had a couple opportunities while you were in undergrad. So I know you mentioned you were very fascinated around brain trauma. So you were a brain trauma tech at Lehigh Valley Hospital. You were a summer sessions assistant at Memorial Sloan Kettering and admissions and registration representative at Pocono Medical Center. So just talk briefly about those positions that you had while you were in undergrad.
Yeah, you know, I really tried to learn as much about the healthcare system as I could. I was fixated on emergency medicine and trauma. I really loved the clinical side of healthcare and wanted to learn as much as I could as a student so that I could prepare myself. You know, I knew that what I was going into was what I wanted to do, right? I've heard too many stories of folks, they get into medical school and then they see their first operation and they say, oh gosh, this is too bloody and gory for me. You know, I'm out. I need to go do something else, right? And so I tried to get as much exposure to surgical procedures and, you know, emergency room things, the clinical side of healthcare, but also the managerial side. I didn't want to leave a stone unturned. I wanted to see the front of the house and the back of the house, how a patient gets pre-authorized for their surgery. And, you know, what is it like to work with the payer side on that? And so that's where the admissions and the registration fit in. I said, you know what, I need to be right there in the front of the house and do those pre-authorizations and register those patients and make sure their information's correct in the system. And, you know, I look back now as a manager and a leader, and it provided me with that street cred to be able to say, I've done this. And I know how difficult it is. And so let me give you the tools and the resources you need to be more effective at that job. And I wasn't exactly looking at it that way when I was doing it. I just wanted the exposure to the healthcare system. But man, it certainly paid off.
And that's so important when you're starting off in any career path, it's just getting exposure to the field that you're interested in. Because like you said, you don't want to go through this entire journey, then end up in medical school, and then you're on the surgery table and you're like blood and you're like fainting. Like at that point in time, you really want to know if you can handle that and all the other things that the career path might really ask of you. Okay, so you're finishing up your bachelor's degree. You almost have enough credits to get a dual major in biology and healthcare administration. Someone reaches out to you and is like, I know you want to go to medical school, but you can do this MHA and then you can go to medical school. But I really see that you have like the eye for doing work. Was that one conversation what sold you on going and getting your MHA, or like, was there more to that thought process?
Yeah, you know, it was probably multiple conversations. I certainly had to think on it, but it was truly the right path. You know, I was engaged in some emerging leadership programs at Scranton and as an undergrad, and was doing some student mentoring for younger students and even through high school, right? I was always in leadership programs. I was an Eagle Scout and I always had this natural knack for leading people and leading teams. And so that's what really pushed me over the edge to the MHA was to say, you know, the world needs good leaders. How do I train to become one? And how do I be the leader that, you know, I saw in my father as a school principal and assistant superintendent, and the way that he took care of his people and the way that he, you know, managed and led his teams, and, you know, other leaders that I didn't see that. And I saw more negative approaches. And I said, you know, I could really make a difference here in the world of leadership and management. And, you know, how do I gain the skills and stay humble enough to be able to do that effectively?
Okay. And you didn't continue on to become a physician. I'm not too sure if you did the MCATs throughout that time while you were in your MHA or not, but what in the MHA program or throughout your experiences in that program made you decide that you wanted to continue on doing this work, maybe on that more leadership management side of things?
Oh, man. You know, the exposure in the program to trying to fix problems in the healthcare system, looking at, you know, public health from a broader scale and looking into, you know, hospitals and long-term care facilities and just the depth and breadth and scope that healthcare and public health have across the nation, I realized that I could probably have a bigger impact on the healthcare system and, you know, meeting my own personal mission to change the healthcare system in this country, or at least wherever I am in my community, for the positive, with the MHA, going the leadership route, then becoming a physician. And I had some physician mentors even who said, you don't want to do this right now. You know, we look where healthcare is going and we don't know. And, you know, there's so much uncertainty. Well, you know, there's still so much uncertainty in public health leadership, right? And so you're always going to have that volatile, uncertain, ambiguous world that we live in. But where could I make the biggest difference? And it was the experiences that I had along the way, you know, not just as a graduate assistant, but being able to work at the new Geisinger Commonwealth Medical School as that was being created, being able to work at the Regional Cancer Institute that was right on campus, and really dive into SPSS and statistical analysis and epidemiology and try to find cancer clusters across the region. Completing a countywide, you know, health needs assessment for the very first time, and just diving into all of these public health concepts and health system concepts that got me really excited. And I said, you know what? This could be cool. This could be something that I do for the rest of my life. And, you know, being able to facilitate those groups as a young grad student and, you know, really learn. I had lived in Northeast Pennsylvania for my entire life, but sitting down and facilitating those health needs assessment groups opened my eyes to a world that, you know, me and my white privileged upbringing was not aware of. And it really hearkened to say, hey, you know what? You could change this. You could be someone who makes a difference in people's lives through public health. And so those assessments that we did actually shaped the new medical school's curriculum. And that was also cool to me because we were doing the work on the ground that was going to feed into a medical college to help provide medical students to really impact those needs and to change the health of the community around us.
Sounds like a really eye-opening and beneficial experience that you're able to get throughout your MHA program and really just understand the impact that you could have at like that population level, as well as just realizing that our experience of a community might be very different from the people that are most impacted in a community, and just realizing that we really need to ensure that we're hearing their voices so that we can create solutions to support them and create solutions for the issues that they're dealing with.
For sure. For sure. And Scranton also had really opened my eyes across the world. And they started focusing on global public health now. And I was able to travel to the UK and spend a few weeks with the NHS and see how their healthcare system operates. And then I was also able to spend a few weeks in China and see how their health system operates. And, you know, talk about two sides of the coin. One of the reasons I went to China was to try to understand why traditional Chinese medicine and Eastern traditional therapies are really coming up in use in our country. But when I got over there to China, it was all about the Western medicine. It was all about the high tech, low touch. You know, what can we spend money on and improve healthcare with technology? And it was just truly eye opening, truly eye opening.
That's an interesting perspective to take, like the cycle of how those things are working. We're looking to the east, they're looking to the west. And so it is fascinating. And one of my favorite classes that I took through my MPH was like comparative healthcare systems. So really like looking at world health systems and just because they really do operate very differently. Like when you look at one system, you really look at one system and just seeing the impact that it has. And I think like thinking about how the populations differ and what those needs are is really cool to think about.
For sure.
So after your MHA, as you shared, you were administrative resident at Pocono Medical Center, I believe you said for 6 months. What did you do while you were in this position?
Yeah, wow. It was just a really great opportunity to, again, see all aspects of managing a health system and a hospital. And so some primary projects that I worked on were focused on the physician practices. And so spent a lot of time with data and analysis of patient throughput and how we could improve patient visits and scheduling and reimbursement within the primary care practices at the hospital. One of the most meaningful exercises for me from a back of room perspective was actually going through and helping the CFO clean up the hospital's charge master and get rid of duplicate codes for supplies and medical procedures and just integrate, really intimate work on the financial side of the house. And unfortunately, healthcare in America in 2024 and even back then, it was a business. And so getting exposure to that side of the house, helped me understand why coding is important, why we need to code the right way. How do we get paid by all of these payers and generate a full idea of what revenue cycle actually means in healthcare, right? And then, I also got the opportunity to stick and stay in the OR and the PACU anesthesia recovery unit for a while. And help make sure that paperwork was completed and consents were completed to help us boost compliance. So it was just multifaceted, working in HR on some dashboards and employee performance things, as well as the finance and then, operations to direct clinical care. So just full spectrum.
Yeah, that's awesome. To get that right after an MHA, I think is one of the things that we really ideally should be trying to do, because while we still have gotten all those experiences, we still don't fully know what is out there. So I think like any residency fellowship programs are really helpful for early career professionals to really get their hands on so many different aspects of a business, of an organization, and really get you like that full range of understanding. And after this role, you shared earlier that US Department of Veteran Affairs reached out to you, and you told them that you can start because you said that you already decided to start this residency, and lucky enough, they extended it. And I think that goes to the point of if you're the right candidate for the job, like they are going to bend and try to do things that accommodate you. So I think that just shows like kudos to you for making yourself a candidate that they were willing to do that for, because not everyone will get that type of response. So tell us about that fellowship. And then you had an extensive career at the VA. I will list out some of the positions that you had. You were the health system specialist for operations at VA Maryland Healthcare. You were the health system specialist to director at VHA Office of Emergency Management. You were the chief administrative officer in Greenville, North Carolina, and then the chief operating officer, I think, at the same office. So tell us about that pathway and those experiences that you had.
Yeah. You know, that's a lot to cover in a career, you know, just in 10 years, right? And so that was one of those things where I just took every opportunity that was presented to me. And going into the fellowship, it was just an amazing opportunity to get exposure into the whole VA healthcare system. And so met a group of about 25 other fellows from across the country. And we just had a great time learning about the healthcare system, working on different projects. I was based in a VISN office, or a Veterans Integrated Service Network office, in Linthicum, Maryland, right outside of Baltimore by the airport. And we oversaw the Baltimore VA, VA in West Virginia, Washington, D.C., and had a little bit of Pennsylvania in there as well. And just to be involved in a regional healthcare operation like that and go out. And that was the first time I realized that if you've been to one healthcare organization, you've only been to one. And every single organization has its own individual culture, its own individual challenges. We all have similar challenges across ourselves, you know, whether it's in healthcare or public health, but they're very unique organisms, right? And I've just applied that learning to every system that I've been a part of, and having that understanding that even departments can have their own unique culture and ways of thinking. Then, you know, 6 months into that fellowship, an opportunity came open at the Baltimore VA, and I was able to jump right into being the health system specialist, or really the executive assistant to the chief operating officer of the Baltimore system. And, you know, as my first real boss, right, Nancy gave me every opportunity. And she was just an amazing cheerleader for me, and everything that you want in a boss. She listened to, you know, my struggles, gave me opportunities to succeed, gave me opportunities to fail, and created a space so it was safe to do that, and created that learning experience that, you know, it was truly, truly impactful to me. And, you know, I think I lead the way I do today because of her in many ways. And then, you know, being able to learn from the chief operating officer and help with strategic planning or facilities management or logistics and purchasing, all of those different aspects, you know, gave me a good, well-rounded experience in that facility. Then I moved and took a job in Washington, D.C., and I tell folks, it is the most fun I ever had in a job. It was 24/7, 365. Hospital operations, health system management, and emergency management for all 1,700 sites of care. Guam, the Philippines, Puerto Rico, Hawaii, Alaska, everywhere that there's a VA medical center, we were there to keep a pulse and provide support. And if there was a hurricane or a wildfire or an active shooter scenario or a flood, we were there to provide operational support, to deploy assets and resources, to make sure that veterans got taken care of, but also that the VA's fourth mission, and the VA's fourth mission is to provide support to America's healthcare system when it becomes overwhelmed. And so in a hurricane, the healthcare system becomes very overwhelmed, and the VA steps up and provides opportunity to support with mobile clinics, with personnel, with the NDMS teams to go in and provide supplies, pharmaceuticals, equipment, et cetera, to take care of patients, help move patients from facility to facility, And I was just one tiny little small part of that in the DC office. And it was just so much fun to know that we could help save lives and take care of people, even when the storm showed up. Then from there, I transitioned down to North Carolina and quickly realized that I was not built for the South, but had a ton of fun, had a ton of fun in Greenville. East Carolina University, ECU Health was right there, and Eastern North Carolina AHEC was right there next to our facility. And if I was there, that's, 4 years, 5 years, and had just the awakening that I needed to be in rural healthcare, and I needed to do something differently. And so as I was learning in that Greenville role and running my own VA health center for 13 counties in Eastern North Carolina, towards the end of my stint there, I had the opportunity to hear from Tom Morris, who's HRSA. He's over HRSA Rural Health, and he was giving a talk on rural health care and what we did in Eastern North Carolina. And it was at that AHEC training that I realized I needed to do something different. I needed to go into community health. I needed to go into public health. I needed to go into a rural or frontier like we are here in Montana and change lives and change the world. And so I was juiced up after that AHEC training. And Dr. Bassnight, the AHEC director down there, and I still talk about it. I said, you helped me find my place and find my passion and hold on to it because it was an AHEC that did that. Area Health Education Center for those indoctrinated. I am just a champion now of the AHEC movement, and we actually host an AHEC here, Eastern Montana AHEC here at Riverstone. And so that was kind of the apex of my career, if you will. And I said, hey, I need to do something different and go find something else. And that's then when I decided to leave the VA.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for your work at the VA. I think that is so important that you're sharing, like, even throughout all the experiences and all the different learnings that you've had and the exposure that you've intentionally taken out throughout your career, there were this moment at the AHEC that just, like, lit up and was like, okay, I've done all these things. This is where I need to do. This is where I need to go. We never know when that is going to come. But it's so, so important to just be open to those opportunities and then seeing when it does come up, like, moving and saying, okay, this is like, I've learned, I've gotten the experience, I've built all of these things to do this kind of work. Let me now go and do it.
Yeah.
Before we move on, you said earlier on that the bureaucratic management and policy at the VA was difficult for you. Maybe do you want to talk a little bit about how the difference in the management style that VA has compared to what happens at Riverstone?
Yeah, you know, we're the county health department, so we are still a governmental entity, but we are also uniquely one of the few public model federally qualified health centers across the country. And so as the county health department and the healthcare delivery entity with a home health and home hospice arm, we're able to stay separated enough from county government and bureaucracy so that we can still be entrepreneurial in some of the approaches we take to addressing the needs of the public, to implementing really cool, you know, public health programs or parents as teachers or NFP programs, or, you know, opening new lines of business across the community health center program. You know, we're still very dependent on contracts from the CDC, from the state, from HRSA, from, you know, for the federally qualified health center. But we are able then to be a little more nimble than the big government agency is, right? And I think that's the beauty of your local health department And that's the beauty of your local community health center, is that the feds really realized and have admitted they're not the best ones to, you know, provide public health and healthcare within your own community. Your own community is. And so here, let us give you the resources to then go do. And now, do we need more of those resources? Absolutely. Do we need Congress to pass additional funding this week? 110%. So we can be more effective and be more nimble here on the front lines of public health and community health and truly make a difference.
Okay. And you spoke a little bit about what you do at Riversilva, but I'm going to take you back. So after the VA, you had two positions before you came and became the president and CEO of Yellowstone County Health Officer at Riverstone Health. So those two positions were, you were a fellow of the American College of Healthcare Executives, and then you were a senior vice president and chief operating officer at Choptank Community Health System. So tell us about those experiences and then leading into your current role.
So the fellow wasn't necessarily a position. The being a fellow in the American College of Healthcare Executives is really ACHE's way to make sure that executives and healthcare leaders are receive board certification. And so FACHE is our professional organization's way to board certify healthcare executives. And so it really makes sure that we are up to date and we are competent in managerial core competencies, IT, finance, general healthcare knowledge, professional ethics, HR, laws, quality and performance improvement. And so I said very early on in my professional career, I want to achieve board certification and become a fellow of the American College of Healthcare Executives and get that professional recognition. Just as I want to go back and, you know, within the next 5 years, try to get, you know, my CPH certification and be certified in public health. And then hopefully someday get a doctorate or two. But continuing that desire to be a lifelong learner and never satisfied with the status quo. So that's what the fellow FACHE was all about. You know, after my epiphany at the Eastern North Carolina AHEC, I started job searching and found a role back at my wife's home in Maryland. But on the eastern shore of Maryland, more rural, much more rural area than the Baltimore-Washington corridor. And we were looking to move, get back closer to family. We had had our second daughter at the time, and we were looking for the right opportunity back in Maryland. And I was applying to roles and had a couple interviews. And then in one interview I had, the person facilitating the interview said, yeah, you're overqualified for this position. What are you applying for? And really took the time to ask the candid question. And I said, I'm looking to move back home. I'm looking to get my family closer to family and settle back in Maryland. And he said to me, well, you know, we don't have a role for you, but I know somebody who does. And made a couple calls through their professional network. And that's how I found out about the chief operating officer at Choptank on the Eastern Shore. And that ended up being a good fit to get us all through the major part of the pandemic. And so I was there on the Eastern Shore of Maryland for the majority of the first 3 years of COVID. And as we were winding down that initial response, I got a call from a recruiter, and that brought me here.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Like, whoever knows, you know, you go into this interview and they're like, you're overqualified, but then they still connect you to someone, which I think maybe it's like that person's like, okay, this person's going to be an asset to our community. Let's see how we can like plug them into this work while they do want to come here. So that's really cool. And I didn't realize the FACHE was a board certified credential, because I've seen it a lot more on LinkedIn and people's profiles. So I'm glad that I'm educated updated on that now. So yeah. I appreciate you sharing that. So what kinds of work did you do as the Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer?
So I started as Chief Operating Officer at Choptank about 2 months before our first COVID patient arrived. Mm-hmm. And so the majority of my work was as the Corporate Incident Commander for Choptank and really helping with our Chief Clinical Officer in that clinical, non-clinical dyad. We truly helped lead the response patient treatment and recovery efforts all throughout COVID. And that took up the majority of my time. But as a chief operating officer, I was responsible for our facilities program, for all of our satellite clinics, for overseeing our school-based health clinics and mobile integrated health program. Couple months into the pandemic, our local county health officer actually resigned. And so we picked up the slack and really helped the local health department. And that was my first official interaction with a county health agency. And, again, enlightened me and opened my eyes and said, hey, this is something that I ought to think about pursuing one day, right? And look, here I am.
Right. So at Riverstone Health, you've shared some about, you all have a public model FQHC, which is kind of unique around the U.S. You also shared that you all have the FQHC, the health department, the home health and hospice, and there may have been some other things that you mentioned there. Can you talk more about the work that you do at Riverstone and, what Riverstone Health is about?
For sure, yeah. So our primary mission here at Riverstone is, like I said, to improve life, health, and safety. We've got about 450 staff here. We've got 8 clinical locations. 2 of those are school-based health centers. We are the county health department for Yellowstone County, Montana. And we have 4 primary mission essential functions, as I call them. And that's first, to be the city county health department. Second, to be a federally qualified health center and provide clinical care across our region. Third, we're a home health and community hospice agency. And then fourth, we are the education and training hub for the future healthcare providers that are going to take care of our rural and frontier communities here in Yellowstone County and across Montana. And we have 3 assets there, the Montana Family Medicine Residency Program, of which I'm happy to say we matched 9 out of 9 slots last week for match week.
Congrats.
Yeah, we train 9 new family medicine practitioners every single year. And 60% of our program graduates actually stay in Montana, and they stay here. And that's the goal of the program, is to bring family medical providers to our state, to our region, to provide rural health care. And then we also are home to the Eastern Montana Area Health Education Center, and that's our pipeline. That's our high school to healthcare pipeline, and we want to expose as many kids to clinical careers, to public health careers, to home health careers as possible, so that they get interested in healthcare really early on, like I was, and they pursue it, and they stay here, and they become a hygienist or an epidemiologist or a sanitarian. Or a nurse, and they stay in their community and take care of its health and well-being.
Earlier in the episode, you said you may come back to this, and I'm going to make sure you come back to it. You're talking about the East Coast and the West Coast and then Middle Country and the divides. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, Amari, it's about, as I was thinking about a piece of advice that I give my younger self, it's about getting comfortable in the gray zone. And so often I mentor young health professionals and they are idealists, and I'm an idealist. And it's really hard to not be an idealist and want to change the world and do great things, right? I used to think of the world in terms of success or failure, black or white. It ain't that way, folks. the world that we live in is one giant gray zone, and the truth is somewhere inside that gray zone. You know, we across this country have backed up into our own respective corners, whatever they are, politics, religion, personality, identity, and we have to find a way to come together in that middle. We have to sit around the table. We have to meet each other where we are, and we have to learn how to play in the gray, because that's where things get done. That's where solutions are created to our most pressing societal problems. And it's, to me, I look at it, you know, in public health, we want to make the healthy choice the easy choice, right? But in order to do that, as public health professionals, we focus on helping our clients and our patients make incremental change. Too often, and I know I was there as a young millennial coming out of college, I wanted the world to change tomorrow or yesterday. I wanted it to happen right now. You know, we don't demand that our clients stop going to McDonald's twice a week the day we see them. We ask them, we motivate them to stop going to McDonald's twice a week, maybe once a week, then maybe once every couple of weeks, then maybe once a month, right? We ask them to limit, you know, so we don't go in guns blazing and have our side or their side. And we can't do that if we're going to solve the problems that we're currently facing. And so, you know, getting people to think the way we do is what we go in. That's our instinct, you know, whether it's right or wrong or left or right. And we know that the possibilities for creating solutions are way greater in the in-between than they are on those two extremes. And so we've got to become more comfortable in that unknown. We've got to become uncomfortable in the gray. We've got to be okay being uncomfortable. We've got to be okay to be a little bit vulnerable and ask questions and understand where each other are coming from. Because I promise you, what somebody thinks about those flyover states or middle America or frontier Montana by living in LA or New York, some of your assumptions may be right. But I guarantee if you come here and you sit with us and you spend some time in this community, you'll find that more of those assumptions are wrong.
Thank you for highlighting that and the call to action, I feel like, of just having conversations. And I think too often we do pull away and we stay to people that only have ideas and solutions like ourselves. And it's important to have a broad range of thoughts and voices. And just as we like highlighted a lot, it's like listening to understand and just giving space to be on that table and knowing that there's no right and wrong per se, but everything is on a spectrum and we have to figure out how we can bridge those gaps in that gray zone.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, that doesn't mean giving up your principles, giving up your core beliefs and giving up your core ethics. That is not what I'm talking about, because I don't expect the other side to be doing that either. But we've got to be willing to listen and at least have a dialogue.
Right. And I wanted to ask you, so you have a lot of experience now in rural health. What are some advice? What are some pieces of advice that you'd give on rural leadership?
Ooh, you know, besides being willing to listen, rural leadership is all about relationships. It's all about the handshake and looking somebody in the eye and being willing to sit at the table and generate solutions together. You can't come in guns blazing, you know, thinking that you understand the problem and have the solution. It's got to be a collaborative approach, and you've got to bring the detractors and the supporters all around the same room and come up with community solutions, because our rural communities are willing to put in the work. Sometimes they just need some support to be able to do that and a facilitator to help them get where they want to go.
Love that. Love that. So before I move you on to the Furious Five, I wanted to ask, where can people connect with you and where would you like to see yourself in the future?
So come visit us in Billings, Montana. We're here at riverstonehealth.org is where you can find more out about the Yellowstone City County Health Department. Please reach out to me on LinkedIn. It's ForteJ2 out there on LinkedIn. I make my profile and photo available, so you'll find this ugly mug out there. but don't be afraid to reach out. Send me a message. And, you know, for the foreseeable long-term future, I am going to be right here in Billings, Montana. I got three young girls to get through high school, elementary school first, and then high school, and off to college. And, you know, we are settling in, and like I said, becoming a part of this community and really loving this place they call Riverstone. So please don't be afraid to reach out.
Awesome. So moving you on to the Furious Five, the five questions that I ask all guests. Number one, what advice would you give to a student trying to pursue a career in public health?
You know, whatever career you're chasing, make sure you're in it for the right reasons. Make sure that you're, you know, you got your head on straight and you really have a passion for what you want to do. And you're not going to get rich financially in public health, but man, you are going to get rich in purpose, and you're going to find fulfillment in a public health career wherever you choose to go work. Find a mentor. Find somebody who's truly committed to your success. Maybe it's a boss. Maybe it's a colleague. Maybe it's a professor. But hold on to that mentor and value that relationship. Don't be afraid to be a mentor to others. Just because you're a young professional coming out of school, undergrad or grad, you can be a mentor to somebody else too, because your experience is going to be valuable for them.
Number two, if you're talking to someone wanting to get into your position, what advice would you give them?
Same advice somebody gave me. Be willing to put in the work. Don't rush up the ladder. It's really, really easy to put the blinders on and say, I want to become a health officer. I want to become the director. I want to become CEO. Be willing to put in the work. Spend time enjoying the view on the way up. Sometimes I failed to do that on one position to the next. But it really is worth savoring that in the moment. And be willing to take a lateral. A lateral position is not always a negative, and quite possibly it could be a career accelerator.
Number three, what's something you are working on improving in your life right now?
Oh gosh, it's decompressing and transitioning from work to home and home to work. You know, first and foremost, I am dad, I am husband and partner. And, you know, my biggest challenge in life is making time for that and disconnecting that when I go home, you know, I'm no longer the county health officer or the CEO. My wife's the CEO. And I got to make time to put the phone down, be present with my family, and disconnect from work, unless there's some crisis or emergency brewing. But even then, you know, take that time to make space for you. And my transition ritual during my commute has become audiobooks, so that I leave work at home, listen to my book, and get into the house.
Love that. Love that. Number four, professionally, do you recommend anything?
Yeah, back to the audiobook thing, right? Working on that transition period from home to work and work to home, pick a great audiobook. I professionally love listening to public health readings and to self-help, you know, professional development. Think Malcolm Gladwell and Adam Grant. But, you know, pick something that works for you. It could be re-listening to Harry Potter. I think I'm going to be working on that next, because my oldest daughter is just read all the books and wonders why I haven't. But, you know, I think I love listening to different thought leaders. And one of my favorites, and a book that I recommend to everybody, is called Betting on You, because it helped me post-COVID pandemic, post the height of the pandemic, to really refocus on what I wanted out of my professional life and my career, what I wanted out of my personal life. And so a friend of mine, a colleague, Lori Rudiman, she's down there in North Carolina, she wrote a book called Betting on You. And it's about how can we take control of what we own in our professional lives to help us find fulfillment in our careers. And it's about building personal accountability, being authentic, becoming a continuous learner or staying a continuous learner, the power of networking, and the power of resilience. And I just highly recommend that to young professionals and mid-careerists and even senior careerists, because it will truly give you an introspective look on your life and your career so far.
And last but not least, if there was one piece of advice you'd give to your younger self, what would that be?
Oh, gosh, Omari, that was the being comfortable in the gray zone and learning that it's okay to fail. And so since I talked about being comfortable in the gray, give yourself the grace to make mistakes. I remember the first time that I failed at anything, at least to my recollection, was when I was 15 and I failed that permit driver's test for the first time in Pennsylvania. And that hit me so hard. For whatever reason, I had failed before that. We all had, right? But that was the very first formative impact in my mind where, oh my gosh, the world is ending. I failed. I didn't get what I wanted the very first time. And so whether that was a college rejection letter or a med school rejection or whatever that failure is for you, give yourself the grace to process that and work through it so that you know that that's not going to be the last time you fail. And it's not going to be the last time you make a mistake and end up with mud on your face. And that's really helped me become a better leader and a better manager and create that space that Nancy gave to me to create a safe place for breaking down the status quo. When you do that, when you challenge what's out there, you're going to fail. You're going to make mistakes, but get comfortable there and power through it, because if you're doing things right, it's going to keep happening.
Love it. Love it. Well, thank you so much, John, for coming on. I thoroughly enjoyed hearing about your experiences and how it all works together to get where you are and the wonderful work that you're doing. Thank you so much for taking your time for coming on today.
Omari, thank you. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you. Take care.
Yeah, my pleasure. Housekeeping items, everyone. Thank you all so much for watching or listening to this. Be sure to subscribe if you have not as yet, and be sure to share with a friend. See you all next week.